This is Kiara Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and our panel today is going to be discussing microgrid updates and new developments in microgrids and also community microgrids and what's happening in that area. So we're going to start out the panel with Shalom Flank. Next person talking will be Craig Lewis, Clean Coalition, Patrick Moran, Dwayne Morris, and Baird Brown at Eco and Law. So go ahead, Shalom.
Okay. Well, good afternoon to the East Coast. Good morning to everyone else. I have two things that I wanted to highlight. One on the commercial side, which I would identify as continuation of a trend toward energy as a service, microgrid as a service. That what we're seeing at multiple sites is a desire for microgrid implementation to include not only the installation and financing and operation of microgrid equipment, but extending to the full suite of energy services. So for a concrete example, if you were putting in a new solar and CHP as part of a microgrid with islanding capabilities, et cetera, in an area that is also served by centralized hot water or steam chilled water, which of course makes it such a good candidate for a microgrid in the first place, then on the implementation side, whoever comes in for the microgrid, the site host or the owner or the community wants them to take over on the heating and cooling side and the O&M and maybe even the distribution system and the pipes as well. So that's a natural evolution, I think. But one of the issues that it raises and something that I would love feedback from the group on is how you quantify that value. When you're looking at the financial desirability of the microgrid to the end user, taking over those operational responsibilities, I probably won't result in any reduction in utility bills. It's not that kind of a financial advantage. It's much more on the risk reduction side. So what's the right way to quantify that and to fold it into the mix of the overall favorability of the microgrid investment? So that's number one. Number two that I want to bring to the group is more on the regulatory side. And this is fresh in mind because it was the subject of a many hours long meeting at the DC PSC yesterday, but I'm seeing in other contexts as well. That as we look for community microgrids to be able to go beyond the campus setting and serve a variety of customers and especially residential customers. And we'd mostly be talking about multifamily apartment buildings in this context. From the regulatory perspective, how do you provide equivalent consumer protections, equivalent quality of service commitments to what the larger regulated monopoly distribution utility provides without creating such a regulatory burden and such an expense that it makes the microgrid impossible to implement? And one particular approach on that I'm interested in hearing others experience with would be a set of safe harbor provisions to say that this relationship is going to be managed essentially through private contracts, enforceable contracts, but the regulators have a role to say, here's what has to be in the contract, and as long as you meet these requirements, then you have safe harbor from regulatory interference. What would those safe harbor provisions look like? Are there jurisdictions that are working those out? I think that could be a nice, easy path forward to providing some of that regulatory reassurance without creating a burden that's going to endanger projects. So that's my update.
All right. I have one person here with a 717 phone number. Do you want to identify yourself, please?
Yes, this is Rachel Smucker with Secure Futures. Secure Futures is a solar developer in Stanton, Virginia.
Good, Rachel. I'm really glad you could make it. I just wasn't sure who you were. So, super.
Nope.
All right. Okay. So, Craig, why don't you give us some information here?
So, this is Craig Lewis. For those of you who do not know me, I'm the founder and executive director of the Clean Coalition, which is a nonprofit entity that is focused on the mission to accelerate the transition to renewable energy and a modern grid. And almost everything that the Clean Coalition focuses on is on the distribution grid, so where you have wood power poles as opposed to steel power poles. The distribution grid, of course, is close to where people live and work, and that's where you need energy. So the Clean Coalition is most you know, essentially entirely focused on local renewable energy and other distributed energy resources like energy storage, demand response, and monitoring communication control solutions, and everything you need to essentially get high penetrations of local renewables and ensure that it delivers the trifecta of economic, environmental, and resilience benefits to communities. So when the Clean Coalition looks at microgrids, we basically have two categories of microgrids that we work with. The traditional microgrid is a behind-the-meter microgrid where you have, let's say, solar and energy storage and monitoring communication control solutions behind an individual customer meter. So it's you know, a microgrid is designed to provide economic, environmental, and resilience benefits to a individual customer of a utility, and which is great. Microgrids are wonderful, but they're very targeted in terms of where the benefits flow. The benefits are really retained by the individual site that deploys the microgrid. The other category of microgrids in the Clean Coalition's view of the world are called community microgrids. And community microgrids are essentially taking that microgrid functionality and bringing it out to a target grid area. So this would be an area that would be comprised by maybe an entire distribution substation. So this would be perhaps, you know, a square mile of grid area, and obviously include, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of utility customers in it. A community microgrid could also be defined along a individual distribution feeder. So along each distribution substation has multiple feeders that come out of it, typically speaking, at least. And so you could just take one of the feeders and into a community microgrid along, and you can even do it along a subsection of a feeder. But the key to a community microgrid is that all of the sites that are involved are, and all of the distributed energy resources that are involved are tied together electrically, which means they either have to be on the same feeder or served by the same electric substation. And the reason that community microgrids are defined this way, and they need to be electrically connected in this way, is that when there's a grid outage, and in order to get the resilience benefit to the community, you have to be able to share the energy generation, which in a microgrid means the generation is predominantly coming from local renewable energy resources, and you need to tie those energy, those local renewables that generate the energy together with other DER like storage to make sure that the local renewables can provide indefinite renewables-driven backup power to the critical community facilities that are within that community microgrid. So typically, the Clean Coalition has designed about a dozen community microgrids around the country, and within that community microgrid footprint are always critical community facilities. So think fire stations, hospitals, emergency shelters, critical water and communications infrastructure that people, you know, will rely on. They are mission critical when there's a disaster to help ensure that you recover from the disaster. And so community microgrids are very much about providing everyday benefits in terms of energy and economics to the communities where those community microgrids are based and where those distributed energy resources are deployed, but also making sure that the grid is configured such that you will have resilience to the community, energy resilience to the community, starting with the Tier 1 loads, which are the critical community facilities. So we tier the loads in a community microgrid from Tier 1, which are mission critical and life-sustaining. So mission critical, think about the dispatch at the fire station, right? They have to have dispatch in order to coordinate their firefighting operations and other disaster recovery. Life-sustaining, think about a hospital. You've got life support equipment that runs on electricity, and if the grid goes out, you still need to keep that equipment running or people will die. So mission critical and life-sustaining we put into the same Tier 1 category because essentially life depends on mission critical and life-sustaining loads. So that's Tier 1, critical Tier 1 are critical loads. Tier 2 are priority loads, so these are loads that you will keep on if you can without threatening the ability to keep your Tier 1 critical loads on. And then Tier 3 loads are everything else. And generally speaking, in a community microgrid, about 10% of the loads are Tier 1 being critical. About 15% of the loads are Tier 2, those being priority. You'll keep them on if you can do so without threatening the ability to keep your Tier 1s on, which Tier 1s have to be indefinitely provisioned with power backup, renewables-driven power backup. And then the Tier 3s are the other 75% of the loads. So Tier 1s about 10%, Tier 2s 15%, and Tier 3s about 75% of the loads. And the Tier 3s, you can keep them on as long as you have plenty of energy availability. But as soon as you start to have any kind of restriction on your energy availability, you would turn your Tier 3s off. Your Tier 2s and Tier 1s on, but you start turning your Tier 2s off as soon as you run into more energy availability constraints, and you need to turn your Tier 2s off to ensure that you have indefinite renewables-driven backup power for your Tier 1s. Important to a community microgrid is the ability to monitor, communicate, and control. So we refer to that as MC squared, monitoring communication control is MCC. So MC squared playing off of Einstein's famous formula for energy. And the MC squared is absolutely, that is the area in community microgrids that needs the most innovation still. So a lot of times these MC squared systems are referred to as distribution energy resources management systems, DERMS. There's lots of other names for them, but we've just distilled it down to the fundamental functionality that's going on, which is you need to be able to monitor your critical loads and your critical resources that comprise the community microgrid, and you've got to be able to communicate that data that you are monitoring, and then you've got to make control decisions to get those control commands back out to those loads into the and resources. So this really ties in with one of the key challenges of doing community microgrids successfully is recruiting proactive participation from the existing utilities. And you could think, in the future, the utility could be just a distribution system operator where that DSO is, 100% focused on operating the distribution grid and becomes much more aligned with the concept of community microgrids in general. Because when you think about it, community microgrids are a new approach to designing and operating the electric grid, and doing it in a way that is stacked up with local renewables and other distributed energy resources. I think I will stop there and let other people chime in, and I'll have lots more to say as we move along the discussion.
Okay, sounds good. Patrick and Moran, do you have anything to add on that? He's from Dwayne Morris.
Sure. So, yes, as Sierra just said, I'm Patrick Moran. I'm an attorney with Dwayne Morris in their Washington, D.C. office. Two, I guess, updates of sorts. One, on Monday and Tuesday, I attended the Microgrid Global Innovation Forum North America, put on by Smart Grid Observer. There were a lot of it was a smaller conference. There were a lot of the regular players there that you'd expect to be at a microgrid conference. It was a good conference, I'd say worth attending if you haven't gone to one before. A couple of very simple takeaways that's not going to be earth-shattering for anyone is that several of the speakers stressed the importance of having storage within a microgrid system. Some went so far as to say a microgrid can't work without storage. So that was one point. Another point is that everyone recognizes and agrees that the current statutory and regulatory frameworks within each jurisdiction in the United States are not compatible with or supportive of microgrids, and changes need to be made. So it was a good conference, and like I said, nothing earth-shattering. The second item is I had the pleasure of sitting in on that DC MedSys meeting that Shalom referenced a few moments ago, and hearing his presentation, and it was a very, very good presentation. I think it would be beneficial for this group if they get a chance to hear it as well. So that being said, my thoughts for the moment are with respect to the statutory and regulatory changes that we all agree need to be made, but in the meantime have not been made, and granted some jurisdictions like DC are in the process of at least addressing them. I don't know if they're going to actually make them, but at least addressing them. And thinking about how, in the meantime, community or utility scale microgrids could actually proliferate under the current utility paradigm. And, yeah, I just wonder, and confess my own ignorance here, just if you have something, a project where it's not all neatly and conveniently at the end of a feeder, or spread over several contiguous properties, and you have no choice but to utilize the utility's distribution assets to make that microgrid function. Besides hoping the utility plays along nicely, I guess I'm struggling to understand how that can get done, I suppose, by contract, but I think that might become cost prohibitive if you're entering into contracts like that with the utility. So it's one query. And then the other query is just mentioned a moment ago, that if the utility paradigm does shift to more of a DSO, distributed system operator, looking at how that process will unfold and when much of the deregulatory and restructuring in this country occurred, I was not an attorney then, and I was not even remotely focused on the subject. So I've pulled a few books off the shelf, and I'm kind of reading through that history and seeing what issues arose and trying to think of what we can point to on a going forward basis as issues that may arise again as we sort of take the next iteration of that process of changing the utilities from the, well, first, if they're vertically integrated, they're going to be going through two cycles of evolution to get to the DSO platform. But if they're already in a restructured market, they're going to go through at least one iteration of evolution and what that might involve, and just sort of the quid pro quo that may be involved. So those are kind of where my head is. Nothing definitive to say, just questions that I'm thinking about.
All right. Vera, do you want to make some comments here?
Sure. Thanks, Sierra. Just a quick note on one thing that, or two things that Shalom said first. One is that a bunch of my work involves governmental entities that are subject to complicated procurement rules. And one of the ways in, I think, all 50 states that you can avoid some of the complexities is with guaranteed energy savings agreements. And in most states, they vary some, but not a lot from state to state. In most states, they cover water and wastewater savings. And at least in the Pennsylvania statute, they now allow you to count additional revenues as well as savings. So that when you're thinking about a, whether it's as a service or whether it's as an installation kind of arrangement, putting everything together, including all the energy efficiency things you can do at the same time and sizing your system right for the efficient, you know, campus or building or neighborhood, you know, instead of sizing it before you do the energy efficiency, is the right thing to do. And you usually what you can do is make it all pay for itself together when you look at all the different pieces. And the contracting structures for doing that, I guess we're still working out some of the things on the energy as a service side. I'm doing water metering, water sub-metering for low-income housing as a service right now. So, I mean, there's all kinds of pieces that you can play into that with. I want to second your raising, and I know from my colleague Chris Barrett in the MedSys process that consumer protection is going to be an important component of the discussion. I've just finished two rounds of briefs in the Hawaii microgrid tariff proceeding, and it's certainly being raised. The thing I'd point out is that Hawaii already has an interesting, lots of states have landlord exceptions that you can make use of for certain purposes if you're talking about one building or one set of properties all under with a common landlord. And in the Hawaii landlord exception, they've got built-in consumer protection that requires disclosure in your lease for your tenants as to what the electricity arrangements are, how the price is determined, and, you know, basically giving full disclosure with regard to what those arrangements are going to be, which is interesting stuff. And I think it's sort of where, at least in part, the MedSys proceeding is going as well. Others can comment. I think sort of reacting to some of the things Craig said, well, I mean, first of all, in the Hawaii proceeding, and the next thing we're going to have starting probably no later than year end is the California microgrid tariff proceedings, which will, I guess, be distribution company by distribution company, but they're going to be treated all together, I guess. But we're kind of gearing up for that. The one of the questions that is clearly complicated is the public versus private benefit. And I want to gently disagree with one thing Craig said. And that is that I should say for those who don't know that I represent the Microgrid Resources Coalition. So when I say we, that's who I mean, we. It's an advocacy group that consists of everybody from nonprofit institutions that own microgrids to people who build and maintain and run microgrids. Taking the example of Princeton University and Sandy, when Princeton University rode through Sandy with the lights on, they not only rode through with the lights on, but they brought all the first responders in and gave them hot showers, hot meals, let them charge their cell phones and go back into their black neighborhoods around Princeton. And, you know, they were an immense part of community resilience, even though there was no contractual relationship for that. But then also, and this goes back to some things that about the grid of the future that Craig touched on, in as you move to what I think Craig and I agree ought to be the grid of the future, which is the DSO and the ability with the DERMS to the area wide controller, if you will, to let microgrids and just distributed generation generally support each other and support local areas of the grid. Having the grid fairly well tiled and having the distributed energy out there and having that distributed energy have the kinds of controls that microgrids bring to it is going to be part of the public benefit, even if there's no other specific resilience benefit to other than the people behind the meter. So it's part of the solution. And I'll point to the first experiment from ComEd in Illinois, the Bronzeville project, where they're taking the IIT microgrid and one that they're pulling together themselves in conjunction with local generators and then building it into a cluster so the switchgear is in place so that the two different microgrids can support one another in emergency situations. And I think that's sort of the very tip of the iceberg of the grid of the future. But hopefully we want incentives for microgrids to occur, even though maybe that it's not obvious that they support anybody except the people behind the meter. The last thing I'll say about that is that in the Hawaii proceeding, we put in a suggestion for two kinds of tariffs that the PUC could put in place to support that. One is just a plain public benefit charge for any microgrid, but then we suggested that be scaled with respect to FEMA-identified critical loads that were served by the microgrid. And I don't know quite how that fits with the Tier 1, 2, 3, and I'll be interested in hearing Craig talking about how you take the whole end of a feeder or a whole substation and manage to only supply, how you do the load shedding within the microgrid to only supply the Tier 1 and 2, because that's going to be complicated. But load shedding, even within customers, not just Tier 1, 2, but, I mean, so we don't need we could all live for a fair amount of time without our air conditioning if we had to. There's a lot of micro load shedding that you can do. So we did that. And then the other thing we did is have a sort of a rudimentary suggestion for islanding that wasn't at the choice of the microgrid, but at the choice of the grid operator for up to 100 hours in a year, for example, no magic to the number, and suggested that could be a service that would be compensated. And we got some pickup even from HECO on the latter one and from some of the other interveners on the, including the National Solar Association. So I think I think there's a lot going on. Oh, well, and the last thing, I agree with Patrick absolutely on the statutory changes and the definition of utility, which all the interveners in Hawaii united to say, yes, change the definition of utility. Make sure a multi-customer microgrid, that doesn't use the utilities wires is not a utility. But we'll see where that goes.
Okay. So we're going to let the panelists have some discussion among themselves, and we'll open it up to other people. And, Larissa, I see that you're online here. If you'd like to make some comments, fine. Otherwise, I'd like to have you on a call by yourself at a later date because I know you have a lot to say.
You want me to chip in a little, or you want to move on to them?
No, chipping in a little would be perfect. Go ahead.
Hi, all. I agree very much with all the comments, and I think what you're doing, Baird, that's great. You know, the things you're mentioning in terms of the Hawaii proceeding, and I think I think we really all got to work hard together because they're just great potential here, and I told you, Shalom, that I really enjoyed your PowerPoint presentation. And I think, within the D.C. Metsys, it really brought home crucial questions and issues to the group in the D.C. Metsys proceeding because, the types of questions and comments that were raised after Shalom made his presentation, I felt, made it clear many did not understand how a microgrid works. By what they raised, it seemed like these issues they're considering for the first time, and here we're moving to the end of this proceeding. And Baird mentioned the definition of the utility. I think the definition of microgrid needs to be clarified, and if there's just too much diversity here, I'm working on, at least a consistent definition for advanced microgrid capabilities that could support community microgrid development. I also find it discouraging that, within this proceeding, it's always DER systems and how you activate individual DER and missing the point about the overall energy management system capabilities and how they produce more than the sum of the parts. And I think, trying to capture that in the legal changes and that microgrids just can't be sort of shuffled into just generic DER, and you have to recognize their distinctive capabilities, I think is just vital to laying the foundation for community microgrid development later. Like in this proceeding and so many others that I've been involved in, and that's why I say, what you're highlighting, Baird, in the Hawaii proceeding and the California, continue on there are just so vital, is that so many of these proceedings, all we do is work on these business model classifications. How many numbers of customers, does it cross the public way, and yet coming out of this D.C. proceeding, we still don't have solutions. I guess we're supposed to infer that some kind of exemption is necessary, but, until yesterday, Department of Energy and Environment, DOEE, and I think that's with the acronym, but in D.C., on its flow chart, this is the first time within the entire flow chart that I saw the word value, in our whole discussion, I raised it at the beginning of the proceeding, but I see a failure to look at capabilities of microgrid technology systems. I see failure to home in on the value that can be created, and then how that value could justify developing, say, numbers, performance metrics, et cetera. That's really missing in the proceedings that I've been involved in, and that includes California and New York. Also, given these capabilities, and here I think I missed some of this, but, you know, Baird and others, and caught, like I said yesterday, I heard Shalom's presentation, and I've heard Craig's before, but I think that it's also very important to address microgrid as playing a vital role in grid modernization, and that, in fact, evolving microgrids, to me, has a direct bearing on the other side, what are the system needs to accommodate these new types of resources and their capabilities, and shaping the DSO, as well as making a lot of other changes in the grid architecture and functioning and planning to be able to work in a more interactive and compatible way, you know, between the evolving community microgrid and grid side of the picture. And because so many of these jurisdictions, and this even includes the progressive ones, seem to kind of silo microgrids, and again, in a way where you begin again, what are the business classifications, the number of customers, they're not dealt with in a holistic fashion within the grid modernization process itself, what they contribute to it, how they can shape it, and I feel that's integral to evolving community microgrids. I think, though, however, in terms of some of the progressive states, what they are doing is moving in the right direction in terms of performance metrics, but reforming the traditional regulatory compact to realign it with realign the utility incentives with long-term customer value. But within those kinds of changes, as been proposed in the New York REV and also in terms of a lot of the work, California, the valuation, the part that's missing is distinguishing microgrids from the rest of the pack. And again, this shuffling in, this just wrapping microgrids into distributed energy resources, I believe hurts the microgrids from the standpoint of their distinguishing characteristics. And if you don't recognize those distinguishing characteristics, then our regulatory reforms are not going to be designed in a way to attract the kind of investment you need to lift, for evolving community microgrids. So those are my overall, sentiments.
All right. Well, I should open it up to few discussions here.
This is Craig, I want to agree with a lot of what Larisha said, and I think she hit on a number of things that address comments that Patrick brought up, and so getting to the value of community microgrids is really critical to ensuring that we can have the regulatory framework that we need for community microgrids to happen, including getting the utilities to participate proactively or reactively. But at the end of the day, if the utilities don't participate proactively, then we need to change our policy strategy to make sure that there is ultimately policy edict, whether it starts in legislation or at the regulatory bodies, it ultimately comes out and gets implemented in the regulatory bodies for an edict that is imposed on the utilities. And in California, just a couple of examples, we have SB 1339, which is the essentially the community microgrid bill that got passed last year. We also have AB 2868, which is a prior bill in California that is dealing with local energy storage requirements, and it is an active proceeding at the California Public Utilities Commission. In fact, the Clean Coalition submitted some a filing last week that will be very interesting to just about everybody on this call, I believe. So I will send that filing to Sierra and let her get it circulated around. And I think particularly the folks who are involved in California policy proceedings will find that to be very helpful. There's also the wildfire policy that's happening in California, which really sets up the opportunity for community microgrids, because you know one of the big issues with wildfire your critical community facilities are going to be out of service unless you find a way to keep them powered. And the Clean Coalition is working in lots of places that have been hit by the wildfires of California, have been hit by the landslides. And one of the really compelling features of community microgrids that is getting a lot of traction out there is the fact that they can provide indefinite renewables-driven backup power. And a lot of critical facilities, most critical facilities probably, already have diesel generators in place or maybe a natural gas generator, some kind of fossil-based generator. But both of those types of generators are incredibly vulnerable and inherently not resilient, because diesel generators only have enough ability to keep the lights on for as long as you've got liquid fuel supply right next to the generator, which is usually on average about 2 days worth. So after 2 days, your lights go out. In a big disaster, in a long-term outage, you're going to go way beyond 2 days without the ability to resupply that liquid diesel fuel. Also, natural gas generators are generally dependent on pipeline natural gas, which is way more vulnerable than electricity. When the natural gas grid goes down, it's down for 90 times longer than the electric grid on average. So it is huge vulnerability to be dependent on any type of fossil fuel, whereas renewables, if you can see outside, you're getting solar generation, and if it's windy and rainy, you might be getting very low solar generation, but you size it to your worst case solar resource day combined with your energy storage amount, and you can design for your critical loads to have indefinite renewables-driven backup power. In terms of another way to get the utilities to really be focused on community microgrids and distributed energy resources in general, is to force utilities to divest their transmission investments. So in California, we have a historical precedent of forcing the utilities to change the way they invest in things. In the year 2000 or so, so-called deregulation. It was just re-regulation in California, but they called it deregulation. The utilities were forced to divest most of their generating assets. And right now, in the midst of the PG&E bankruptcy, due to wildfire liabilities that PG&E has, they are at a perfect opportunity to basically divest their transmission investments, which coincidentally are worth about the exact same amount as their wildfire liabilities are, about $30 billion. So a very convenient opportunity to get PG&E and other utilities to focus on their distribution grids. And I'll just one last thing. The Clean Coalition has a very significant initiative going on in the Santa Barbara region of California. It's called the Goleta Load Pocket Community Microgrid. That will for sure require lots of policy innovation, and it will require Southern California Edison's participation. But in the meantime, we have the first building block of that is moving forward. It's called the Montecito Community Microgrid. We have web pages with lots of details on both of those initiatives. The Montecito Community Microgrid is three sites, a fire station, a water district, which does all the water pumping, which is needed when you're fighting fires, and a emergency shelter at a local school that's about a half a mile down the street and down the same feeder as those. The way we're doing that, because we don't have full participation from the utility yet, from Southern California Edison, the way we're doing that is we're basically designing three independent microgrids that can island at the customer meter, but we're putting the monitoring communications control in place so that they can participate and stay online, keep those customer meters open, use the distribution grid to share resources in a grid outage scenario. And all of the other customers that are in between, this was a question that came up, that they're smart meters on all of these customer meters, they can be shut off from the network operating center. So you shut off all the non-critical customers, the wire basically becomes a dedicated bus to tie in all your critical loads and your critical generating and energy storage resources. So I'll leave it there with one request to Baird. Baird, if you're working on the grid services power agreement, purchase agreement in Hawaii, the GSPA, I would love to hear more about that on this call.
Okay. Baird?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not working on the grid services power agreement. I know a little bit about it from our work on the microgrid tariff. There are, unfortunately, in Hawaii right now, there are probably at least 10 relevant proceedings going on, at one of which is the one you just mentioned. There's a whole integrated planning process that's going on. There's pressure on HECO to have a new business model. There's a separate distributed energy resource working group that's figuring out what to pay for various kinds of services. So in that sense, microgrids won't be any different. There's definitely a model in HECO's head about sort of more comprehensive, individually negotiated service agreements. But if that's come to any detailed fruition, I don't know it yet.
Anybody else on this? Oh, come on.
Baird, could you talk a little bit about what the microgrid tariff would be? I'm not familiar with that in Hawaii.
Well, the legislature passed a bill that's about a page long that says there shall be microgrids. They're good for resilience, and they'll help us help renewable energy penetrate faster, which is what we want. And UPUC, go make it happen. And of course, other than Maui, which has its own cooperative utility, which was originally a fisherman's co-op, there's no legal structure, you know, specific in Hawaii for that purpose. The Hawaiian electric companies, there are three of them that basically serve all the other big islands. So it's one utility with whom the PUC is very frustrated, and they're trying to drag them into the future. But they don't want to bankrupt them in the process. Microgrids, Hawaii electric rates are in the 30 and 40 cent range because everything is imported. You know, there's no natural gas. There's no anything. It's all basically diesel. Or bunker oil. I mean, it's not even diesel sometimes. But they're not in a non-attainment area, so they can run backup diesel generators once a week to keep them, tuned up. It's a different reality. I've had to try and wrap my head around it. So they don't even think about integrated thermal and electric loads at all, and they do think basically about diesel backup. And it's been pointed out that to have a microgrid that has the capability where there is no natural gas to survive for days, and Hawaii's had 41 days consecutive without sun, at least on one occasion recently, you're going to need to think about fossil, and there are the ability to simply size solar to the worst possible day in terms of the space available is, you know, without paving the jungle or the or other wonderful habitat is probably not there either. So, I mean, there's some complicated trade-offs, but if you are balancing thermal load and electric load, there are huge efficiencies to get, and thinking through that balance is one of the hard things. I mean, you know, some of the urban microgrids in the East, you know, there's barely even enough to put solar for, you know, a third of the load. So it's and I'm an optimist when it comes to how much solar you can put in the city.
Any other thoughts? We have a few minutes left.
This is Larissa. I guess just to add two other things. It is, you know, I think to focus all of us on the institutionalization side when it comes to resiliency. And, I mean, to me, I've been working on this for a long time, but, like, something came to fruition, but it kind of reflects the frustrations. Finally, they made a change in the Stafford Act so that the wording isn't rebuild in the same manner, but, you know, build better. And it took decades just to get that change. But, you know, that wording is just so significant. And now to try to leverage it and within our existing institutional structure when addressing energy assurance, emergency preparedness, response, and restoration frameworks, we really need to get in the wording that can help better support putting alternative strategies into play with respect to planning, not just within the box, but in terms of energy assurance, in terms of emergency preparedness, and, you know, boosting it into the non-wire alternative space. And, in fact, you know, even within this DC MITSIS, you know, at first microgrids weren't even mentioned, you know, within the classifications of non-wires alternatives, but it is being included and mentioned explicitly coming out of this proceeding. The other part I'd mention, too, is the community dimension is, I feel, in my experience, really being left out of most of this. And I'll go back, you know, Baird mentioned the ComEd, and here Craig and I got to witness this, and I thought, you know, Craig, you may have your own reactions, but in another SGO proceeding in Chicago, first you had the lineup from the ComEd side, you know, going over the technical aspects and how the, you know, Bronzeville will be interlinked, networked with the IIT, you know, how that will work, the benefits coming out of it. But then the next day you had a panel of the community representatives and how they're mobilizing, and they really do not want to see the kind of business model where the utility is getting around, you know, the prohibitions on owning individual distributed resource energy resources, but instead will be owning everything that controls those resources and therefore in the driver's seat. And both ComEd and National Grid are pursuing that kind of business model. And they're working hard, these community representatives, to not only get a voice in the matter while things are still formative, but to try to evolve the kind of governance structure where the community actually has decision-making, a decision-making role and a big say in what kind of decisions are made that impact the community's interests. And I see this as a plus, but it's a really uphill battle, unfortunately. And in settings like the New York Prize, they're not even thinking in these terms. They feel they need the utility, but I don't think they're thinking through the longer-term consequences.
Okay. We're just about out of time. Well, we are out of time. And what I'll do is I'll schedule another call. The earliest would be June. Maybe I can squeeze one in before then, but it sounds like there's a lot of discussion around this topic, and we need to have more time for this topic. So also I'd like to have you thinking about the solutions. What do we need to do to move forward on this area? There's obviously a lot of issues and problems, but what do you need to do? What kind of discussions do we have to have around that? So our next conference call is going to be interesting. It's on March 26th. And Oksan Bayulujan, I can't pronounce your last name, Oksan Bayulujan, from the University of Connecticut has done some research on why cities or towns are proactive or hesitant about integrating renewable energy. So this should be something that would help people understand more about how hard it is to move forward in certain areas and why. So anyhow, thanks so much for our panelists. Wonderful job, interesting conversation. Hope to see you all next time, and I'll be sending out more invitations to future calls in April. And thanks again.
Thank you, Sierra.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.